So, there was a misunderstanding, though, about a topic of tonight. There was a misspelling on the thing we're talking about, early Christian sex. Okay. I'm dying up here. that. We got, I really enjoyed our session yesterday on violence. Oh boy, I'm sorry about this. I've been taking lots of stuff, so I might go over. I will do my best to do my duty.
So not only is there sex, there's also drugs.
Yes. Violent sex, and drugs. Yes, thank you, Tom. We're on a roll. That is not just me. That was pretty dead, wasn't it? it was really, I really enjoyed it yesterday. I would pick up Dean's book there to plug it once more, but I don't want to contaminate it. Walter Reed's Powers to Be, really great overall interpretation of the significance of Jesus in his context and obviously for today too. The first chapter is a little dense. It goes over his stuff on the powers, but it's really interesting. But if you start it and you think, what is this about? Just keep going, because it gets really good. We had some fun acting out some of the Sermon on the Mount yesterday with the slaps. What we didn't act out, though, and what I'd like to start with today is the courtroom scene, where the person is left naked. Never mind. We didn't act that one out. Okay. Let's get serious. Because this is a serious topic. And I think the seriousness of it is directly proportional to how much we laugh about it, because we laugh about it because it's a laughter is a dissonance dissipator, right? And it's an uncomfortable subject. And so we laugh. But the first thing to note about this, we're looking at the whole week we've been looking at Jesus' moral vision, how it fit into his particular context. We've noted his emphasis on justice from the prophets, his emphasis on overturning human conceptions of power, and his emphasis on as Alan puts it, making the circle bigger, and including outcasts and things that we've heard for a long time, but. He didn't say that much about sex. And so and that's important for a couple of reasons. One, the Bible as a whole doesn't say much about it. Our interest in these issues is way out of proportion to the Bible's interest in it. Our interest in sexual issues is that the Bible has... is something like 80 or 90 explicit passages. actually, if you read Genesis lately, you'll know that most of them are there. the word for justice occurs like over 1,000 times or something like that. There's some, it's way out of proportion. That's not to say it's not important. But it is a little more difficult to get a sense for what Jesus might have talked about. We do, however, have a couple important passages. What I want to look at today is Jesus' general attitude towards sex, to begin with, from what we can tell. Second, his views on marriage and divorce. That's, of course, another really huge topic for us, and that's a topic on which Jesus did weigh in, I want to double up on my preposition. Because I don't have enough voice to do that. So I'm going to try not to say anything extraneous. Surprised somebody didn't say, how's that going for you? And then And then we do want, I do want to just spend a little time near the end talking about the homosexuality issue. So that's our ambitious agenda. First question, which, I don't know, was Jesus a sexual being? Okay, next question. Let's hear more about, was Jesus a sexual being in the fullest sense of the word?
Well, if we believe he's fully human and fully divine, I think we have to accept he was every piece of it.
Anybody have issues with that? Or want to put any nuance on it? Or?
Well, according to Dan Brown, he was married.
Yeah, and he is the authority. it's an obvious statement, but I think it's an important one to draw from, because if we have this vision of Jesus as God coming down to earth, and kind of striding this far above the earth, like, you notice, I made almost no reference to the Gospel of John. It's not because I don't like it, it's because there really isn't much ethical teaching in it. It's all about believing in me. And the Jesus of John's Gospel is I know it's a caricature and it's debated, but it's much less human than in the other Gospels. I mean, the Church, of course, has debated this issue about Jesus' sexuality. And the famous scene in The Name of the Rose where they're debating about whether Jesus laughed or not. I think it's an important thing an important starting point, that he experienced human sexuality in all its complexity. That's not saying anything about any sexuality in which he participated. But we have to think of him as someone who understood that. I mean, even Hebrews says he was like us in every way except sin, right? So, all right, we got that settled. But I think that does provide an important perspective that Jesus understands, that Jesus, and if we're working it with an incarnational Christology, then God understands our sexual nature. Well, I mean, God created it. God has a sense of humor because, I mean, why else would God make it? Our principal goal in life is to connect with other human beings, right? And especially one significant partner, a soulmate. And yet, it's impossible to do. So it's got to be a sitcom. It's for God to some extent. One area to take a little bit of note of too is that Jesus did not avoid women. And again, not something to take for granted. Jesus was not an ascetic, right? I mentioned last night that he was he was accused of being a glutton and a drunk compared to John the Baptist, who was an ascetic. He lived out in the wilderness. The Essene, he might have been an Essene from Qumran. That's one potential connection between the early Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I wouldn't put much on that, but he was certainly, I mean, for him, asceticism, for him, he did not, all his disciples were male as far as we know. But Jesus, and he didn't drink or eat with, but Jesus came out, and Jesus. And people accused him of being a glutton and a drunkard. So he, because of who he ate with, and the turning water into wine and all that stuff. But Jesus had women companions, female companions. It's a remarkable thing in his culture. You know all the stories about that and the way Jesus welcomed women and the way he challenged patriarchal structures. My favorite scene, though, in terms of Jesus' interactions with women, is the Syrophoenician woman, the woman who comes from, I think, Syrophoenicia. That's just a theory I have. She begs him to cast a demon out of her daughter. And what does Jesus say? Do you remember the story?
Does he say no?
Yeah, basically. But how does he say it? He says it in a rather cultural, insensitive, un-PC way. He says, it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. She's Syrophoenician, which means she's not Jewish. And Gentile dog was a common ethnic epithet that was used and hurled around. He was like us in every way except sin. This passage, of course, I've mulled over many times to think, is Jesus participating in a prejudice here? Is he doing it with what I see as the twinkle, the gleam in his eye, and just seeing what she'll say? I guess probably more along that line. But the important thing here is that Jesus, whether he's really participating in a prejudice, it's fine if you don't want to go there, or whether he's having a fun tete-a-tete or whatever. He allows himself. What does the woman say to him?
She says, don't even the dogs get the scraps that fall from the children's table.
Don't even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the master's table. All I need is a crumb. And what does Jesus do? You're right. Go away. What has Jesus just done? This is in public, by the way. What has Jesus just done? He's allowed himself in public to be instructed by, to be bested by a woman. to put, again, regardless of his intentions, he's put himself in a position that the woman actually humbled him. I can't say anything to that. And that's absolutely extraordinary in terms of the patriarchy of the time. It's one of my favorite stories. So Jesus, Jesus had female companions, and he treated them as equals, as far as we can tell. More than equals, according to this story.
Jim, would the word, in addition to sexual, sensual, come into play with Jesus' interactions with women and men?
Oh boy. Well,
that stretch.
I don't know. I don't know if that was a word. I said, of course, the word erotic comes from the Greek. Jesus spoke Aramaic, but I don't know if that's one of the favorite things that Hollywood does to Jesus' story is make a sexual tension between Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Well, he was allowing women to touch him, which was a terrible taboo break.
Yes.
And not only, especially the one where she's drying his feet with her tears and all that stuff. That's
hair.
Really inappropriate. Even today, that would raise a few eyebrows.
Absolutely. This woman comes while he's at table and wipes his feet with her hair, cries at his feet,
How would that go over the fuel?
It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And both of these scenes, Syrophoenician woman and we can't lose sight of the outrageousness of Jesus, and the iconoclasm of Jesus. Jesus' willingness to really make people uncomfortable. How uncomfortable could that, how uncomfortable must that have been?
Could you say that Jesus is in bad taste in some ways? Because he's constantly creating these disruptions like this.
Yeah. Some certainly thought so, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Some have seen him as being influenced by the cynics, the classical cynics, who, not classical, but in the technical term, a cynic is one who approached life as being an iconoclast, as one who didn't have a house, completely bucked conventional wisdom in conventional ways, and Jesus is often seen in those ways.
assume that he is really accepting people from perhaps outside of the circle in that respect?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I've already referred to his image of the widening circle. I love that image, and it certainly, Jesus drew the circle.
Our pastor likes to say that Jesus worked from the bottom up.
I don't have any history, but what's the history of the time, you know, of contemporary writings of that time as far as portraying sex?
Portraying.
Okay, you go back to when the Bible was written.
Mm-hmm. And portraying it in literature?
Yeah, you look at other literature of that time.
Yeah.
Is it portrayed?
Yeah, in Genesis it has. I mean, in the Hebrew Bible it is. You know, the Hebrew Bible gets pretty graphic.
Okay, but
think of Onan, I mean, spilling his seed on the ground.
But New Testament time.
There's frank talk about sex in the culture, not in Jewish culture so much, but in Greco-Roman culture. Okay. They had
dirty graffiti.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mount Vesuvius.
Yeah, porno on the wall.
What's the place called? Pompeii. Yeah, they had, you know, the Roman, you know. I haven't seen it, but I knew the movie Caligula is not that far. He was. But for in Jewish
where
culture,
I'm going with that is, you know, is this a, you know, do they use euphemisms in the Bible that would have been common?
Yes. In fact, the feet is a euphemism for the genitalia. Absolutely. Yeah. If you remember that crazy story in Exodus 5, I think it is. After God calls Moses to do all this great stuff, and the burning bush and all that, and then Moses, and then God comes into Moses' tent that night and tries to kill him. It's one of the weirdest texts in the whole freaking Bible. And his wife circumcises their infant and puts the foreskin on Moses' feet, which clearly is a reference to Genesis. So yes, I mean there's all kind. Yes, this is. I don't know if you call it erotic, but a scene like this with the woman is certainly, provocative.
It's like to Don's point, there's touching.
Right, there's touching. Yeah. Touch. I mean, Jesus wasn't afraid to touch anything.
Right.
You know, one of the things, I'm not saying this about here because actually it's been remarkably different, but one of the things about our new awareness about how colds are spread, have you noticed that when you say you have a cold, the first reaction is more like stay away, yeah, you know, as opposed to I'm really sorry, because all of a sudden you become a carrier of disease and germ, and I've been struck by that because now we can all picture, you know, it's made obsessive compulsives out of all of us. We can picture the germs on the doorknob. It's a good thing, but at the same time, yikes. Jesus would give me a hug no matter what, whether I was sneezing or coughing or, I knew that he'd give me. Okay, so, Jesus treated women as fully human persons. Even women for whom sex was possibly an incident, a woman caught in adultery, this woman who wipes her hair on Jesus' feet. By the way, who is that woman? Right, good. Well, that's nice to hear. You say it's Mary Magdalene. No, it's not Mary Magdalene.
It's a prostitute.
It's just, well, we don't know that either. Yeah. It's just a sin.
Just a
woman.
Sinful. Oh, they just described
it. We fill in the gap. I mean, maybe she was a shoplifter. Who knows?
Maybe she shoplifted the oil that she put against the
fence. Yeah, exactly. There you go. But
because how else would she get all that money for that?
Yeah. I mean, Mary Magdalene, and she's associated with the woman caught in adultery. We don't know who she is. Mary Magdalene is just a woman from whom Jesus exorcised demons, and then she hung around with Jesus. It's a strange thing we do. And you know, let's not miss the fact that the two prominent women in the Bible, one is a virgin and one is a prostitute. Right. I mean, it fits our typologies so well. But it's not there. It's not what Jesus was about. Okay, so next thing I want to say, these are just obvious things, but important things to point out. Jesus was a sexual being. Jesus hung around women and seemed to be comfortable with sexuality. Third, Jesus affirmed sex as a gift from God. Let's not. In his culture, there were those like the Essenes, who for whom sex was, and of course it develops in Christianity. As Christianity develops, you know, there are sex come to see sex as bad. Then we get to Augustine. That's leaping way forward, but there's a trajectory that sees that develops in Christianity that sees sex as something dirty and bad and sinful in and of itself. But Jesus didn't say that. The one passage what we want to look at, who wants to dare touch one of these? No. I should have passed around that sentence. No, I did.
We're sorry.
We're going to look at that. Let me give half of them. Or why don't you give half of them? Or do you mind grabbing that? You're my helper. Teacher's helper. Let's just establish also that sex is not a bad thing. When we look at Mark 10, the question of divorce. We'll look at this more obviously when we talk about divorce. But he quotes, if you look at Mark 10, verse 4, that's not what I'm handing. Well, actually, that is on there, but that's not what I'm handing out right now. Jesus said,
do you have any copies for upstairs?
We can or share between two people.
Do you have like shield glasses? You can just look down. I'm not really thinking very well. So Jesus responds to the question about divorce by quoting a verse from Genesis. The importance of that will come to in just a minute, but just notice that he quotes approvingly from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Jesus repeats it. You know what I'm saying? There she go. this is God's intention for creation. Sexuality is. Okay? Enough said about that. God created sexuality. It is not an evil thing. And interesting to note here, of course, and this is sort of a bit of a foreshadowing. Notice what part of the Genesis text he doesn't quote. Interestingly. I mean, what is the, because one of the things we're going to want to come back to, we will have some time to talk about homosexuality. What is the purpose of marriage?
Procreation. The purpose of marriage is...
If you just had this text that Jesus quoted here, what would you say the purpose of
marriage? Get the kids out of the house.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
The two become one flesh, right?
Right.
It's about... Two human beings becoming one flesh. It's not. Jesus is not quoting the part here. This is that people will multiply and all that. God created the male and female. He even quotes the part from Genesis 1. It says God made the male and female, but then doesn't quote the part. And this is different from one flesh. It's an argument from silence. But one of the things obviously we want to look at is what was God's intent, or how do we understand God's intention for marriage, and how has it been understood in the past? I think my finger's down about 101 now. So, sex is not a bad thing. Sex is God's gift. Now, obviously, it's a gift that can be misused and is misused with regularity. And with irregularity, worse. but the place where confusing, complicated sex, because we have this famous passage from the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. What's adultery in biblical terms? Well, let's just start. What's adultery in our terms? When we hear this text, what are we talking about adultery? Yes, cheating on your spouse. Sex outside of your marriage. Right? What is it in the biblical times?
Offense against property.
Right. Adultery in the original Ten Commandments, and I think this is still the case during Jesus' time, was an offense against whom?
The husband.
Huh? Adultery is an offense against whom? The man committing adultery with a woman. Can a man commit adultery in biblical times? Can a man commit adultery with an unmarried woman?
No.
No, it's not adultery, because adultery is. Is what then? Yeah, when you have sex with another man's wife, because you have violated his rights to that his rights to that woman. So this is an example of false cognates, but you know the term, the phenomenon of false cognates. You use the same word and you think, you know, they use the same word, but they mean something completely different by it. And it's really important to understand that in Jewish tradition, that's what adultery is. It's important to understand both, just for clarity's sake, as well as to understand how we have developed these important terms over time, right? These terms have not remained static. Our laws, I think now, and I couldn't say, where's Peter? No, our laws, I think now, define adultery as, you know, that either a man or a woman can commit it, right? I think so. I'm going to have to start with you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. All right, then. This is where we get this where we get this idea of sensuality, of sex. Anything involving sex is bad, because sex is just for procreation, and it can involve. This seems like an impossible ideal, doesn't it? Seems like an impossible ideal. Pardon?
Oh, he's talking to the Pharisees, though, wasn't he? At that point.
He's the Sermon on the Mount. He's talking to his followers. He's laying out the higher righteousness that his followers have to follow so that they exceed their righteousness exceeds the scribes and Pharisees. So it is in the introduction to this. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. Yeah. That talks about pouring cold water. is it first important to note, of course, this is not an attack on sex. What is it an attack on? I mean, what is Jesus trying to get at here that he doesn't think the original commandment does?
Your heart acting outside of love.
Uh-huh. Pardon?
Acting outside of love.
Yeah.
Your heart.
The heart. Uh-huh. Yeah, because what is lust about? Where does lust take place? In your mind and in your heart. And I lost my train of thought there for a second. It's a concern for what was my question? I'm sorry, my mind just drew a blank.
What is Jesus trying to get at?
Yeah, it's not an attack on sex. It is a, nor is it an impossible ideal. Remember we talked about yesterday, Phil, you were with me, about a third way. In terms of Jesus found a third way between violence and pacifism. That is to say, active, not resistant. Well, this is sort of a third way with sex too. It's not either all bad or all good. It is a matter of paying attention to what you pay attention to. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. This is the point I was going to make, is that what level of what he does to the original commandment is really put it in terms of one's intention. That it's not simply a matter of action, it's also a matter of intention, right? One of the things that I think is really important to note about the Sermon on the Mount and these so-called antitheses, these you have heard that it was said, but I say to you they're called antitheses. And you know, the first one is, you have heard that it was said, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. So what on a simplistic reading of that, what has Jesus just told us we can't be?
Angry.
We can't be angry. But wait a minute. Is that what he says? Then look how he illustrates this. So usually we see this as in the past, there was this way, but now there's this way. So it's a two-part saying. But what if it's a three-part saying? Authors of another really good book takes a little more conservative slant on things, but it's evangelical social justice kind of book. It's by Stassen and Gushy. It's called Kingdom Ethics. And what they have, I don't remember which one of them has developed this idea, is that the antitheses are actually three-part sayings. They're tripartite. They're triads. And they're not setting forth impossible ideals. But let's look at this one, because it's really clear in this one. You shall not murder. Whoever murders shall not be liable to judgment. Chapter 5, verse 21. But I say to you, if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. Now, is that an imperative? Is that a command? What role does anger play in murder?
Precedes.
Yeah, it's the prelude to it, right? And the anger comes and builds, and if the cycle keeps ramping up, the result is going to be violence, murder. So this what Jesus is talking, he's pointing out. Is the result of anger, result of that inner disposition, leads you to want to kill someone. What is Jesus actually, in this antithesis, in this section, what does Jesus actually command people to do? Where is the imperative? Well, if you remember, he goes on to say, so when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, well, in other words, what might be the case? You've got conflict, and maybe anger, and maybe, you know, something's not right with. So Jesus doesn't say conflict's going to go away. And he is talking about a brother or sister. He's not talking about some grievance out in the world somewhere. He's talking about in the community. So he acknowledges that conflicts that this is not about never being angry. I mean, again, as this last night, but Jesus, his button was really pushed by hypocrisy. And wouldn't that be hypocritical of him? Because he got very angry. He got angry with his own disciples. He got angry with the chief priest. I like to call his action in the temple his temple tantrum. And so, you know, it was not. That's not what he's saying. What is the actual command? If you and your brother and sister have something off, go and be reconciled to your brother and sister, and then offer your gift. That's the commandment. Be reconciled. It's a complete misunderstanding of Jesus' ethics here to say that Jesus is setting up these impossible ideals. What he does instead is say what the commandment is that we all live with, but then give an example of how there's a vicious cycle that can lead to the breaking of that commandment, and thus the breaking of community and relationships. And then the third part is generally the part where he says, do something about it. It's the same thing with lust. He's not talking he's not saying don't lust with a woman. He's saying here's the cycle. You look at a woman, and of course this can be reversed. You look at a woman, you start having thoughts about her, or a man, you start having thoughts about him and her, and you let that thought fester and go around and around. And then what are you doing? You're plotting ways to get her. Checking that thought, paying attention to what you're paying attention to. Jesus talks later about the eye of my The eye is the lamp of the body. Boy, was he ever prescient in that one, in terms of our visual age, right? What we let into our bodies shapes the way we see things. You gotta think that if you let erotic images into your eyes as a constant thing, it's gonna shape how you see things and shape your desires. So no, it's not. It's of course you're gonna have feelings, but it's the and you're you know somebody's gonna pique your curiosity, but it's totally possible to check that. That's the thing. It's not that you have to completely eliminate all lustful thoughts, but that you need to check, prevent them from moving into that next, you know, like the Rube Goldberg machine comes to mind. You know, it's a cycle, and you gotta stop it somewhere. Just you know, whatever.
Hey Jim.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how that view squares with what I think it's like 5:5:45 that says, and you used it in your Vespers sermon about being perfect.
Ah.
So what might perfect imply with that sort of sense of?
Yeah. This whole section ends with, you know, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Probably a bad translation. That a lot of scholars think that what he's talking about here is perfect in the sense of complete. That your approach to ethics is complete. It involves mind, body, heart. And it just can't be. Jesus acknowledges all the way through that people do get angry, that people do have lustful thoughts, that people do So that's, it's a difficult verse. You might know that in Luke, that same verse is rendered, you must be merciful as your Heavenly Father is merciful. So it's, you know, we haven't gotten much to this week, and that's actually what we're going to talk about now with divorce. We haven't gotten much to comparing the different Gospels, because certain, you know, I've just kind of been pulling things out of many Gospels. I guess I would like to think that be merciful as your Heavenly Father is merciful comes closer to what Jesus actually said, but you know that's a whole other issue. In this context, though, I think of it as complete rather than absolute, you know, perfection. Perfection is a Greco-Roman or a Greek idea, not a Hebrew idea in that sort of aesthetic state of perfection. I don't think that's really a Hebrew idea. That's another way to look at it. Other questions or thoughts about lust? Yeah, and one I didn't bring out is that the Greek construction here is a purpose construction. Whoever looks at a woman in order to lust after her. So it's not, you know, if that's your intent. It's not just looking at another woman. It's looking at another woman with the and then with the intent to want to possess her. Questions or comments? All right, let's look at the sheet I handed out. And, I'll hand out some little gloves if you like. So let's look into the question of divorce. Marriage and divorce, actually. what did Jesus think about it? Well, the only teaching we have about marriage from Jesus is when he talks about it in terms of divorce. And this is a tricky one. This is a tricky one, but it's also extremely valuable illustration of the difficulty in using an ancient text for modern ethical questions. If let's just look at the text in the Gospel of Mark. Someone want to read it? So I can take a rest in the voice. Anyone?
I'll read it.
Okay.
10:1.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. And crowds gathered to him again. And again, as his custom was, he taught them. And Pharisees came up and, in order to test him, asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to put her away."
Okay, so stopping right there for a second. Moses allowed them. So not who's Moses, but when they're referring to Moses, what are they referring to?
The law.
The law, the Torah. And in this, so they're actually alluding to a passage in Scripture, in Deuteronomy, that says this very thing. It's interesting to think about what sort of test were they...
Yeah, what were they? What was that? There's the trap here.
Right. I mean, I don't want to get too far off on this, but here again, I like to think of what I would want to say is that notice it's the narrator who calls it a test. Jesus, during his time, entered into dialogue about all matters of Jewish law with his fellow Jews. You know, what's the greatest commandment? It's interesting that some of the Gospels, like Mark, portray that scene as just a dialogue between Jesus and another Jew, whereas Matthew portrays that scene as a text. So there's one of the things we have to remember is that so much of the Gospels reflect the time in which they were written, which is much later, when the conflict between church and synagogue was really emerging. And the tendency was to put that read that conflict back into Jesus' time. So I'm gonna take the easy way out and just say it wouldn't necessarily have to be a test. It could just be a question. What do you think about this? And when we get to Matthew's version, we'll see even more evidence of that. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
But Jesus said to them, "For your hardness of heart, He wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not a human being put asunder."
Keep going.
And in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery."
Yeah. There's a lot of really interesting things going on in this text. One of which is, how would you characterize Jesus' response? I mean, what's really at issue here between the two of them in Mark's version of this? The Pharisees say, "Well, Moses said we could do it." But what does Jesus come back with? How does he try to...
He says that God has joined you together and this can't be split apart by the law.
Yeah, and so where is he drawing this from? Where is he quoting from? Yeah, he's quoting from Genesis.
Once again, he's using their own thing.
Right. And his own thing, too.
Yeah,
so he's pointing, he's going behind... doing an end run or whatever around this particular rule to look at the principle. This is something that Jesus did often. He objected to, rules. Obeying rules sake. And he would often go to the principle of something. What's really at stake in this? Sure, there might be a commandment from God or a rule from God about this, but what's God's real intention behind this? And in the case of marriage, you have you have some testimony to that, because God joined these two things together. And Jesus' interpretation of that is what God has joined together. Let no, to be gender inclusive is really important, but they really blew it with this... translation in the NRSV, which most of us read, because they have and I think in the marriage ceremony too, let no one put asunder. It doesn't, the contrast isn't there. It's between what God has joined together, let no human being put asunder. So Jesus is going to the source of it. He's going to God's original intention for marriage. Right? It's a really important thing to see that Jesus' own interpretation of Scripture doesn't simply take it as a flat he doesn't take every word of scripture as having the same meaning. He goes behind, and he looks at the deep principle. It's a really important thing to recognize. He was not a fundamentalist. However, what he does say is, no, you may not divorce. Whoa, maybe he is a fundamentalist. Okay, so why? Why does Jesus say this? Why might Jesus be so adamant about divorce, a practice that was, allowed according to God's law, according to Jewish law? But no.
Perhaps the intent. I mean, if he's talking about the heart of the matter, it's just like, okay, it's just a matter of property and a matter of my rights, and it's not, like, it's done on that business deal level as opposed to the heart level.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to the human level. Yeah. That there's some, a move away from sort of seeing it as a transaction and seeing it as actually a relationship between human beings, between two human beings. I mean, let's not forget that why was Eve created? We don't want to get into that in terms of what that means in terms of Eve was created to be in relationship with Adam, and Adam was incomplete without her. So that's what marriage is about. It's not a transaction. It's not simply about procreation. We're all waiting for the Proposition 8 debate to come out. Proposition 8 in California, where they're challenging the law against the proposition that defined marriage as between a man and a woman. And from what I could tell from the arguments, one of the principal arguments of the defense, which was defending the proposition, was to say marriage is a crucial institution in society for the passing on of for childbearing basically, and the judge who apparently is not too sympathetic to them said something like this. He said, I don't get married for the good of the community. I get married because of this relationship. That's what the Genesis text is about. It's about two human beings relating to each other. It's not about how they function, except how they function within God's overall designs for creation.
How come he gives a more explicit answer in private to the Pharisees? And just because they're kind of like, okay, guys, since you didn't get the first answer, let me...
Right.
Is that the reason, or...?
I would say from a narrative standpoint, it's an attempt for the narrator, Mark, to say, for my readers. But that's the way Mark's disciples are always, that's
always...
Yeah,
they're always not getting it.
Right,
yeah.
They're always not getting it. So what was that about? What was that parable? And he explains it. But it's all from the reader, of course. It's all from
the because you always picture Jesus going,
surrounded by it. So what else might be operative here? And this is a really important piece of it too. What else might be operative here in this in Jesus' absolute prohibition of marriage or of divorce? I'm sorry. What happens when a woman in a patriarchal culture like that is sent away by her husband?
That no one can take care of.
Yeah. I mean, context is so important here. Jesus is addressing a context in which women could be, women and children and orphans, anyone not attached to a male, was completely bereft, was completely on the outs. You had, in a patriarchal society, there wasn't, there was no Mary Tyler Moore. she was the single girl in the city, right? There's no single girl in the city. You're a beggar or a prostitute or something in order to make a patriarchal society. So I think it's a really important thing to see here. And when you look at the context of Mark 10, which you don't have on that sheet, of course, look at the context of Mark 10, and the whole chapter is about vulnerable, about the next thing is about children, and well, it's all about justice and taking care of those least vulnerable, or those most vulnerable. Wait, is this session being recorded? I shudder to think. So, I find that a very important point to drive. This is not a matter of being prudish to some rule about marriage. This is a matter of protecting a woman's vulnerability. You notice also, how is this different? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. What? How did we define adultery back here?
Against.
Now this gets really tricky because we don't, because as we'll see here, we don't. There are different versions of this saying that all say slightly different things, and so we don't know exactly what Jesus said. But clearly, in this version, adultery is something that one can do against a woman, and a woman can commit adultery against her husband. So there's something going on here. Some people attribute that to the Greco-Roman setting in which women could file for divorce, but we don't want to get too ensconced in that. But let's go over to Matthew's gospel, because here's where things get really interesting. You hope, right? Now, when Jesus finished these things, so exactly the same scene, but this is Matthew's version of it, and as a lot of you, I'm sure, know, Matthew probably used Mark as a source. But he's writing in a different context, right? Large crowds followed him. And Pharisees, chapter 19, verse 3, came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? How is that different from the question in Mark?
Divorce his wife.
Right. Just divorce his wife for any cause. This is kind of fun, but because this is even more something that comes out of the context. What Matthew is the way Matthew puts it seems to show familiarity with the different schools of thought within Judaism, and you can see that down at the very bottom of this page. That there was a school of Shammai, which was more conservative, and the school of Hillel that was more liberal in everything, in all Jewish law. And look at that. There's a controversy over what the verse in Deuteronomy meant. The school of Shammai say, a man may not divorce his wife unless he has found unchastity in her, for it is written, because he hath found in her indecency in anything. Notice the indecency in anything. So you can divorce if your wife has been unfaithful, but you can't. But then the school of Hillel says, he may divorce her even if she spoiled the dish for him. For it is written, because he hath found indecency in her indecency in anything. So the stress is on the anything rather than the indecency. Even if he found another fairer than she. For it is written, then it shall be if she find no favor in his eyes. So there's a dispute within Judaism here. And that's maybe a clearer sense of why they approach him about this, right? Because that's the issue that's being debated. But he makes many of the same points in that next section. But look at verse 19:9, which is the version of the verse in verse 11. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. What's happened here?
He's got a loophole.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Do you think this is someone putting in a loophole and just say, we put it in their escape valve here? This
right. That's the question, isn't it? What does Jesus actually say?
Do you have any evidence that that was inserted later?
Yeah, but I'm not going to show you. I think what most scholars say is that yes, this is the point that I actually wanted to make about this. It's not only what Jesus taught, but it's also the way Jesus' teachings were adapted as things went on. It's simply not realistic to not have to not allow divorce completely. You see, this is dangerous territory. I don't mean to lift this up as. But Catholic, official Catholic teaching does not recognize divorce, right? It's because they take divorce. I mean, marriage is a sacrament that God has done, and it can't be undone. So what? But what can happen in Catholic teaching?
Annulment.
Yeah, an annulment, which says what? This marriage never happened. So I mean, the point is, there is no way that human in our present state can avoid some brokenness in our relationships. So. You see, I mean, that's one way to deal with it, right? It's just to say, well, that we never married. Anyway. And then what's really interesting, and I guess this is where we'll have to stop, but it's a good place to stop. Look at Paul, 1 Corinthians 7. He's dealing with the same issue in Corinth. He's writing to the Corinthians. They've written to ask him, you know, the interesting piece there, a completely different context. Now, Paul has started this new community, and you've got a husband and wife. One of them says, well, this is incredible. I'm going to shape my life around this powerful message. The other one says, nah, not so much. And so what you've got this you've got a breach in their marriage. So they say, what should we do? To the married, I give this command. Not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. So, if that's what Jesus said, a wife should not separate from her husband. What version does Paul seem to have been familiar with?
Mark.
Yeah, with Mark's version, just that divorce is wrong. Period. But what Paul does then is start to say, yeah, but it's the yeah, but. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. Some people think that this might be actually referring to a specific case, that by the time the letter reaches you, if she's already separated, then that's fine, but just, you know, let her not remarry. But then he goes on, to the rest I say, I am not the Lord, that if any believer has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. It is to peace that God has called you. You see what's happened here? Paul is kind of doing the same thing with Jesus' statement that Jesus did with the Pharisee's statement. He's saying, what has God called us to? Peace. That there is a criterion here for a life-giving relationship that is deeper than simply the rule about divorcing or not divorcing, right? So you can see that ethics is a very complex, involves a very complex interaction between, an ethical precept or a text and the environment in which it's being interpreted. And this, obviously we're not going to have time, if I'm still, alive in the morning. I will. We can talk more about this at the 10:50 session. I have a 10:50 session tomorrow. But this, I think, it is a perfect transition to the debate about homosexuality because it seems to me pretty clear that the explicit references to same-sex sex in the Bible have very little to do with the question today, little to nothing. No, not the question that we're asking today. Is can two people of the same sex who want to follow Jesus, want to be Christian, marry one another and have the same relationship that a male and female can? That question simply was not asked in those times. So what do we have to do? We have to search for a deeper principle to deal with this. What is the fun? What is, just like we see Jesus doing, when he reads the Hebrew Bible, we have to look for a deeper principle. What is God's intention for marriage, for example? Let me just share a couple thoughts about it. First of all, one of my pet peeves is when people deal with it by saying, "Well, Jesus said not to judge." Don't use that as an argument. That doesn't fly. I mean, that's a cop out to say Jesus said not to judge. I mean, yeah, Jesus said judge not, and you will not be judged. But we have to have, you know, we have to have some kind of standards for behavior. It's not about not judging. It has to be something more positive than that. And I think for me the most important piece, and I think we've done a much better job of showing how the explicit statements about homosexuality, or about same-sex sex, because homosexuality wouldn't be the word back then, don't apply to today than we have in constructing a positive case for it. And that's, I think, where the work has to come. But to begin that, I think that the two places that I wanted to start with is God's intention for marriage. And we've already talked about that. At its most basic, fundamental level, it's about companionship. And we've turned it into that, even if it didn't work there. But I think you find a powerful support for that. That even in Genesis 2 there, it isn't they become one flesh in order to be fruitful and multiply. They just become one flesh because that is the nature of the human creature, is to be in relationship. The second place, of course, is Jesus' emphasis on justice. I think justice is important, both in terms of treating people justly, as well as justice as the criterion for what a life-giving relationship is. Right? I mean, is the criterion for what's a God-pleasing relationship that it's a man or a woman, or that the relationship is mutually life-giving? Mm-hmm. Right? There's ways to go with all that stuff. That's some of the thoughts that I would want to develop if we had the chance right now. That's a lot. Thanks for staying over a few minutes. But we'll stop here. I'm happy to answer any questions.